for solo violin, commissioned by the Royal Philharmonic Society and Radio 3 in 2006. It was played there by Alina Ibrahimova, the performer he wrote it for. I hope you've enjoyed the range and variety of pieces we've heard in this week's celebration of the 200th anniversary of the Royal Philharmonic Society. And don't forget that this Sunday, the 11th of August, the BBC Proms is holding a whole day of celebration for the RPS's bicentenary, culminating in a free concert at the Royal Albert Hall, as the National Youth Orchestra and Chorus, the Irish Youth Choir and Codetta perform the world premiere of a new work by Mark Anthony Turnage, Vaughan Williams' Towards the Unknown Region, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 9. All of which is roughly where we began back on Monday. You can, of course, tune into that live here on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30. And if you'd like to see a list of the works I've played to you this week, just visit the Radio 3 webpage and follow the links.
Composer of the Week was presented by Donald MacLeod and produced in Cardiff by Stephen Rajam. And the programme returns in 2 weeks' time for an evenings-only look at the life and work of Sibelius. BBC Radio 3 at 7 o'clock. Time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Christopher Cook.
Gustav Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection. Marius Janssens conducts the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra in their second appearance at this year's proms, and they're joined tonight by a pair of soloists and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Chorus and the WDR Radio Choir. Mahler worked long and hard on his second symphony. The massive funeral march that begins the work was written in the summer of 1888. Then three shorter movements, a bucolic interlude, followed by settings of two poems from Mahler's favourite collection of verse, Desknab and Wunderhorn, in which St. Anthony preaches to the fishes. Antony's failure, though, to reform the fishes is followed by a second poem, Urlicht, Primal Light. However, it would be 6 years after he'd begun this symphony before Mahler felt ready to tackle the choral finale. The opening movement was originally christened Totenfeier, Funeral Rites, and eager for a second opinion, Mahler played it through on the piano to the great German conductor Hans von Bülow. It was not a happy audition. The venerable conductor simply covered his ears with his hands and groaned. Tonight's conductor, Marius Janssens, takes a rather different view of the symphony.
I think why Mahler is so popular and beloved, because in his music is everything, you know. He's such wide range of atmosphere, questions, philosophical, thoughts, grotesque, love, death, tragic, you know, dramatic, you know, and humor. Everything in this music, and every listener can find something which is close to his feelings and has some kind of inner bridge to his music. Because this is, yeah, how Mahler said, I want to embrace all world.
The fourth movement is Urlicht, Primal Light. And I wonder whether you feel, as you're conducting this, that something really changes as the mezzo-soprano begins that extraordinary song.
Yeah, of course, you immediately to change to the atmosphere, which is, I would say, for me, very spiritual.
Tonight's conductor, Marius Janssens. Ironically, it was Hans von Bülow who had so disliked the first movement of this second symphony who, very indirectly, provided the work with its final movement. Mahler attended the venerable conductor's funeral in Hamburg, and the choir sang the poet Klopstock's chorale, Rise again, yea, you shall rise again, my dust, after a brief rest to immortal life. It was as if I'd been struck by lightning, Mahler said later. Everything suddenly seemed crystal clear. By the end of July that year, 1894, the fifth and final movement of the Resurrection Symphony was completed. Literally, the end of the world with the last trumpet and the promise of resurrection and eternal life. Well, the Bavarian Radio Symphony Chorus and the WDR Radio Choir will be coming on stage in the pause that generally follows the first movement. Mahler himself insisted this pause should be as long as 5 minutes. There are very few conductors nowadays keep us waiting between the funeral march and the remainder of the symphony for that long. But it does give an opportunity, and as Janssens feels, for the choir to come on, and we can take stock, perhaps, of where we've got to by that stage. Tonight's soloists are the soprano, Genia Kuhlmeier, and Gerhild Romberger, mezzo-soprano. And here now is Marius Janssens to conduct Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, with the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, led tonight by Radoslav Schulz.
Thank you.
Rise again, my heart, in an instant. All that you have struggled for shall bring you to God. A glimpse of immortality at the end of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, his second symphony. Marius Janssens conducted the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra in that performance here at the BBC Proms. The soloists were the soprano Genia Kuhlmeier and Gerhard Romberger, mezzo-soprano, and the choirs were made up of the Bavarian Radio Symphony Chorus together with the Westdeutsche Rundfunk Radio Choir. And you can hear the extraordinary, extraordinary response here in the hall to that performance of Mahler's second symphony. Marius Janssens leading his soloists off the platform now. The choir taking their seats. The Bavarian Radio Chorus was founded in 1946. This season they've been to Japan and they perform Mozart's Mass in C minor at the Rheingau Festival, Britain's War Requiem under Marius Janssens at the Lucerne Easter Festival, and also Bach's St. Matthew Passion with the Concerto Köln. And they've also given concerts in Manchester featuring contemporary work. The two soloists returning, Genia Kuhlmeier and Gerhard Romberger, mezzo-soprano, leading soprano, and tonight's conductor, Marius Janssens. Remarkable to watch this afternoon's rehearsal. Very brief in many ways, but you realise afterwards that what Janssens was doing was simply rehearsing those extraordinary transitions within this great symphony, whereby the mood and indeed the music simply turns on a sixpence. Applause now as on the soloist and Marius Janssens are joined by the chorus masters for the two choirs, Peter Dijkstra and Robert Blank. And the whole orchestra on their feet now. An absolutely packed Albert Hall, who listened more quietly perhaps than I think I've ever heard an audience listen to this particular symphony. Earlier today I was outside at the back of the hall and there was some promenaders sitting on the balustrade, the stone balustrade at the back, and we were talking. And they were saying that they thought that the audience this year, and maybe in other years too, but somehow particularly this year, had paid extraordinary attention to the music that they've heard so far, that they really wanted to listen, and they pinned their ears back. Not now, though, as the great thumping on the floor begins in salutation of this great orchestra and their conductor, Marius Janssens, who will shortly be returning, I'm sure. And here come the soloists again with the chorus master and Marius Janssens, tonight's conductor. Well, if you'd like to hear tonight's prom again, then it will be available, of course, for 7 days after broadcast via the Radio 3 website and the BBC iPlayer. Radio 3 is streamed in HD sound online, and you can find everything you need to know about Radio 3's coverage of this year's prom season on the Radio 3 website, Radio 3, the home of the proms. Well, we'll be back in a little over an hour and a half here at the Royal Albert Hall again for the second of tonight's two proms. Sir John Eliot Gardner conducts the English Baroque soloists, the Monteverdi Choir, and a quartet of solo voices in the Easter Oratorio and the Ascension Oratorio, both, of course, by Johann Sebastian Bach. So, in a sense, the musical theme of resurrection sounded in Mahler's great second symphony that we've just heard continues. But for now, I'll return you to my colleague, the Broadcasting House, for the rest of Radio 3 this evening until we return to the hall. Back to Jonathan Swain.
Christopher, thank you very much. Christopher Cook there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to add, there's another chance to hear tonight's Mahler prom on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And in just a few minutes, a Proms Plus discussion recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music about Mahler's conversion from Judaism to Christianity and the social context of the Resurrection Symphony. Well, looking ahead, and there are two proms tomorrow night as well. I beg your pardon, tomorrow. The first is another of the proms, Saturday Matinees, live from London's Cadogan Hall. Pianist Barry Douglas directing Camerata Ireland in a programme continuing the season's focus on the music of Benjamin Britten and his contemporaries. Britten's Young Apollo, opening a sequence of works of brittle, edgy beauty, including Prio Rania's Movement for Strings, Lennox Barclay's String Serenade, Britten's Variations on a Theme of Frank Bridge, and a performance of Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 1 with its dazzling trumpet part played by Alison Balsam. That's tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Radio 3. And tomorrow night's visit to the Albert Hall is quite a contrast to this evening's Mahler and Bach. A dynamic meeting of musical cultures as conductor Jules Buckley brings together the BBC Symphony Orchestra with leading performers from the UK's vibrant urban music scene. That's live here on Radio 3, starting at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. And if that wasn't enough dates for your diary, this weekend at the proms and on Radio 3, the first ever free prom.
Sunday night at the 2013 BBC Proms and Beethoven's boundary-breaking choral symphony. Youth choirs from the UK and Ireland join the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain with principal conductor Vasily Petrenko. Sunday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Well, back to tonight and keeping matters proms related in just over 5 minutes. I beg your pardon, in 25 minutes from now, a chance to hear the Aurora Orchestra in winning entries from the 2013 Proms Inspire Young Composers competition. That's at 9 o'clock this evening. For the moment, with Bach for chorus and orchestra in tonight's late prom, Bach for the piano. The pianist is Angela Hewitt.
Thank you.
pianist Angela Hewitt in the Fantasia in C minor, BWV 906 by J.S. Bach. And we've just time for one more brief piece of Bach from her. This is one of his two-part inventions. Part of the invention number one in C major played there by Bach, and it was played there by Angela Hewitt, and I do apologise for losing the beginning of that.
The Edinburgh Festivals 2013, on radio, on TV and online throughout August on the BBC. And on BBC Radio 3, daily Queen's Hall recitals from the Edinburgh International Festival itself.
One of Edinburgh's loveliest music venues.
3 weeks of amazing music making for mid-morning festival goers.
Coffee, a croissant and a concert the order of the day.
Music from Edinburgh favourites and from stars of the future. Weekday mornings with Jamie McDougall, Marianne Kennedy and, to start the season, Donald MacLeod.
Greek string quartet, as I imagine, you've never heard it before. I know I never have.
The Edinburgh International Festival on BBC Radio 3. Weekday mornings next week at 11 o'clock.
BBC Radio 3, it's 20 to 9. And time now for Proms Plus, recorded earlier this evening at London's Royal College of Music. In the chair is James Jolly.
Welcome to this Proms Plus event, Mahler and Spirituality, and I'm joined by Norman Lebrecht and Jeremy Barham. Jeremy Barham is reader in music at the University of Surrey. His PhD thesis was on Mahler's Third Symphony and its relationship to 19th century philosophy and culture. He's published many essays on Mahler, and a collection of essays, Rethinking Mahler, is due out next year. Norman Lebrecht, no stranger to Radio 3 audiences, thanks to his interviews with the music's great and good, is a cultural commentator, novelist, and author of Mahler Remembered, and most recently, Why Mahler. Being a little bit flippant, I was thinking we could perhaps subtitle this talk, Four Funerals and a Wedding. And I want to start actually at a funeral and take us back to February the 19th, 1889, to the Jewish cemetery in Jihlava, or Iglau as it's known in Germany. Norman, maybe you could sort of paint the picture.
Mahler's father has died. He is, at the time, music director of the opera in Budapest. He's 28 years old, very, very young to be music director of the second biggest opera house in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And with his great sense of family responsibility, he goes back to his hometown for his father's death. And it's quite a shattering experience for him. Because he stays there for a week, from which we can deduce that he observed the Jewish week of mourning, the ritual of sitting in the house on low chairs and people coming to pay their sympathies. And we can also deduce that he said Kaddish, the memorial prayer at his father's grave. We don't know it for certain, but what seems probable is that this was the last time that Mahler took part in Jewish observances, because when his mother died a few months later, he didn't go. And this is a great paradox, because Mahler was close to his mother. His mother meant everything to him. When he was a child, his most traumatic experiences were when she had headaches and he would hide behind her chair and pray for her to be cured. When she was slightly disabled, when she was having marital tiffs with his father and they got quite violent, Mahler always took his mother's side. So to have gone to the funeral of the father whom he respected but did not love, and not to have gone to the funeral of the mother whom he loved but could not protect, is one of those key paradoxes in Mahler's development.
Now, death was ever present in life back then. I mean, he lost a huge number of siblings. I mean, it must have been a very traumatic childhood.
Yeah, I mean, as Marlowe grew up, he saw a number of his siblings die, some at a very young age, some a little bit later. I think at least six of his siblings died in infancy or in young childhood. And, of course, later in the 1890s, in 1895, his brother committed suicide. He was living in Vienna at the time. And Mahler was supporting him and essentially his mentor. He was a musician as well, Otto Mahler. So, yes, death surrounded Mahler's life from a very young age. And that kind of experience, I think, is you can hear and see and feel very clearly in his compositional output. Indeed, the symphony we're talking about tonight, I think, is one of several of his symphonies that tries to address death and the experience of it and how to deal with it, how to move on, how to come to terms with personal, individual loss. And it's also a kind of spiritual exploration of the meaning of life and the inevitability of death. So yes, death does rear its head throughout Mahler's life, both in a personal and family context and in a creative context.
Now, in sort of musical terms, there are a number of funeral marches throughout his music, and they're often sort of mingling with other sounds. I mean, he was brought up basically over a tavern, mm-hmm. so as the children's bodies would have been removed from the house, there would have been the sound of sort of carousing.
That's the first symphony. That's where when you hear in the third movement of the first symphony, you hear a children's lullaby, which we know as Ferozhaka, being transformed into the minor, and then into what sounds like a funeral march. There's this, the tread of the double basses. And what Mahler is doing is he's telling you, he's writing about the death of children. It then turns into this wild bacchanalian dance. And you realize that he's giving you simple autobiography. He's grown up above a tavern. Six of his brothers and sisters died in infancy. There was very little respect given in those days to the death of a young child. There were just formalities. And as the coffin left the house by the back door, the singing and dancing went on in the tavern down below. And Mahler, in the First Symphony, is actually addressing one of the acute social issues of that time and of our time and saying, what is the value that we put on the life of a child? So from the very beginning, he is socially engaged. He is also autobiographically engaged, and he's doing exactly as Freud does in his work. He's extrapolating an incident from his own childhood in order to try and build some larger theory, some larger question that we can all contemplate. When Mahler says to Sibelius, much later, they're going for a walk in the woods, and Sibelius has finished his third symphony. He's feeling very pleased with himself, and he says to Mahler, isn't the symphony a wonderful thing? You can achieve absolute formal and notational perfection. There's not a single superfluous note in my work. And Mahler says, rubbish. The symphony is like the world. It must embrace everything. What he means is it cannot be detached as a piece of formal perfection. It actually has to grapple with the issues that matter to us day in, day out, in our daily lives, in our public lives, in our political lives. That's what he does in the First Symphony. At the end of the First Symphony, there is a sense of something or someone dying, that the hero has died. If you've killed off your hero in the First Symphony, what on earth are you going to do in the Second?
Jeremy, maybe you'd like to pick up that. I mean, we had a funeral march in Beethoven's Eroica, but that was a kind of different thing. I mean, as Norman's left us at the brink of Symphony No. 2.
Well, this idea of the symphony embracing the world, I think, is particularly pertinent with, it's all of Mahler's symphonies, but particularly with the Second. And in addition to being surrounded by funeral marches and death and so on during his childhood and formative years, he was also surrounded by a whole host of other types of music. In Iglau, for instance, where he grew up, there was a very strong tradition of what were called Fiedlerkapellen, or fiddle bands, who would perform at all sorts of occasions. including funerals, but also processions, wedding processions, farmers' processions. In fact, there was an annual tradition in Iglau, which was called the Procession of the Miner's Pick. And this was a celebration of the miners who played a huge part in the town. All of these occasions would have been accompanied by music of one sort or another. Then there's also the folk music that Mahler would have heard in and around the vicinity of Iglau. There are accounts from this period in the 1870s, 1880s, of him walking around the countryside with friends and coming across a band or a group of dancers. And it's interesting to contemplate or speculate what his response as a sort of budding musician was to that kind of music which pervaded his environment, or that a whole range of music. So in the Second Symphony, I mean, obviously the funeral march topic is something which pervades the work hugely, and it underlines the meaning of the work, I think, to a huge extent. But the second movement of the symphony often gets forgotten. Because the first movement's so cataclysmic, the finale is so overwhelming, the scherzo is so striking in its humour, the poor old second movement tends to get neglected. And the second movement is a very delicate kind of minuet, Lendler type of music in a 3/4 metre. It's dance music. So I think that's an example, in combination with all the plethora of other techniques and musical languages and ideas that are in the symphony. This is an example of Mahler's dictum that the symphony should embrace the world. So you've got death, you've got a gentle minuet, you've got almost operatic elements in the work, you've got the very unusual use of physical space in the symphony, which exploits kind of sense of distance and depth. All of this combines to create the Mahlerian symphony, and the Second Symphony is the epitome of that kind of breadth of experience that he wants to communicate or represent somehow in his symphonies.
And while Mahler was, as a young man, going around absorbing all this different sort of music, I mean, what was his sort of spiritual life? What sort of family were they? Were they an observant family?
They were observant. They were, if you ask, what is Mahler doing growing up in Jihlavy? When he was 3 months old, his parents had a little business in a village, and they moved from the village into the town. Why did they do that? Because it had become permissible for them to do it. Until that time, Jews were not allowed to live in a garrison town like Iglau. They were only allowed to enter it by the day, and they had to be gone by 7 p.m. at night. The moment it became possible for them to do that, his parents, with a three-month-old baby, moved, just sold the business, moved into town, started again, started a community, were involved in the community, involved in the purchase of a cemetery, in the building of a synagogue. The father was the chairman of the synagogue education committee, so they were very much engaged as traditional Jews. The extent of their observance, his mother lit candles on Friday night, they probably kept a kosher home, and I'm speculating here, but it's fairly probable that the lingua franca between the parents, at least when they didn't want the children to understand, was Yiddish. Mahler always said that he'd only spoken Hochdeutsch, perfect German, but I think that's quite unlikely. So that's the extent of their Jewishness. He certainly has a bar mitzvah when he's 13. And I think when he's 15 and he goes to Vienna to the conservatory, a terribly young age to leave home and to go into the big city for the first time, he's only been there once before for interview, at that point he starts to separate from his Jewish observances and to look for a place for himself within the wider society and to read voraciously. He's a huge reader of poetry and of philosophy, and his search for the meaning of life is done more through German literature than through the Bible, but he knows the biblical texts and he certainly knows Jewish traditions, and these start to inform what is going to become his Resurrection Symphony.
Resurrection, you know, to a lot of in a Christian country would be considered a Christian term. I mean, where does the concept of resurrection sit in the Jewish faith?
Well, it's an incredibly bold thing of Mahler as a Jewish musician who suffers onslaughts of anti-Semitism in his job at Budapest, somewhat less when he goes to Hamburg as conductor of the opera. But he's very much faced with his position as a minority and as a loathed minority in Budapest. It's extremely bold of him to take what most people would imagine was a piece of Christian Catholic dogma and make a symphony of it. And of course, Mahler doesn't see it that way because he doesn't see the resurrection as being Christian at all. He knows it as a prayer that Jews say three times a day in their observances, in which they ask God for the resurrection of the dead. But the resurrection in Judaism, unlike Christianity, is non-judgmental. It's not the righteous who will arise and the sinners who will stay down wherever they are. Everyone has a right to resurrection. And Mahler, in the text of the Second Symphony, and in his utterances about the Second Symphony, confirms this. Everybody is going to have a second chance. So this is a challenge to Christian dogma. And there were a couple of commentators at the first performance of the Second Symphony who said, this is, you know, bloody cheek. You know, who does this fellow think he is? This is, the musicians shouldn't be writing about resurrections, least of all a Jewish musician. This is a matter for bishops.
Now, in February 1897, I mean, Mahler made the biggest jump in his career. He went to become artistic director of the Vienna Court Opera, which would be later the Vienna State Opera, possibly the most important musical job in Europe. He had to convert, or it was expedient to convert to Roman Catholicism. I mean, what do you think was going on behind that?
It's difficult to be totally certain about this, but that it was merely a change of coat, as Mahler said. I've just changed my coat, I'm still the same. And it was a matter of expediency. It was the only way he would be able to get the job in the current sort of socio-political situation of Vienna at the end of the 19th century.
It was a legal thing as well, Jeremy. Yes, you couldn't be an official at the court opera without subscribing to the court religion.
And he wasn't alone. Hundreds of thousands of Jews converted to Christianity in order to further assimilate themselves as they saw it and as it was seen by wider society, and to gain positions of authority in whatever field they worked. So he certainly wasn't alone. Some of his closest friends did the same thing. So in a sense, on one level, it was a total expediency and, as Norman said, a legal matter. I wouldn't discount the kind of obverse of that, which is that Mahler did have an interest in the Catholic faith. He had an interest in all sorts of spiritual ideas. So, yes, resurrection to him, I think, was something that was not particularly dogmatic in nature. Mahler never subscribed or wanted to feel, I think, limited by any particular dogma or narrow vision of spirituality or religious observance, which is why I think he looked, as Norman said earlier, to a whole range of literature to also find solutions or answers to the pressing questions that bothered him, most especially about spirituality and the nature of existence. One example that comes to mind is Dostoevsky. He was a passionate admirer of Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov novel. There's a quote at the beginning of the novel, which is a biblical quote, and it's the famous, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." Dostoevsky described The Brothers Karamazov as a novel about atheism. And what he meant by that was a novel that explored the nature of religious belief. That's the theme, and the characters within the novel obviously reflect different sides of that argument and that exploration. Mahler was very taken by this novel and the seriousness with which it explored these issues. And that motto, I think, reminds me very, very strongly, of course, of what the text at the end of the Second Symphony says. In order to live again, something has to die. So it's, again, with this symphony, it is dealing with, finding ways of dealing with tragedy, with loss, with the idea of death, and exploring solutions to how we can, as human beings, I think, cope with that situation, which is obviously a kind of universal concern. And Mahler used lots of different musical means to explore that and hopefully arrive at least an interim conclusion. I think, actually, it took several further symphonies for him to get further along the line of answering the question. The Third Symphony is yet another way of looking at that at these deep questions. That goes down the route more of pantheistic ideas and achieving a sort of oneness with nature. I think that's quite different from the Second Symphony, which is in turn quite different from the First Symphony. So the first few symphonies are definitely exploring these issues from different perspectives. And I think he gets these different perspectives from his experience of his spiritual upbringing, from his huge interest in philosophy and literature. One might mention Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and also a little-known German philosopher called Fechner, who explored exactly the same, or very similar ideas, the ideas of life after death. Is there existence after death? If so, what, you know, what form does that take? So there's a whole panoply of ideas that come to play in Mahler's creative process. And the Second Symphony is offering, I think, one perspective. It's a huge perspective, but it's one perspective amongst others that appear in his early symphonies.
He doesn't want it to be a Christian resurrection. He doesn't want it to be a Jewish resurrection. He wants it to be a universal creed.